Crumple and the Quacks. When you come to think about it, there is no relationship more important than that of a man with his quack, or a regular medical attendant, as Soapy Sam Ballard would no doubt use to call him. A legal hack relies on his quack to raise him to his feet, to keep him breathing, to enable him to cross-examine in a deadly manner, and then, gentle as any sucking dove, move the jury to tears. Without the occasional ministrations of his quack, the criminal defender would be but a memory, an empty seat in chambers to be filled by some white wig with a word processor and a few unkind anecdotes in the bar mess. There might be tears shed around Brixton and the Scrubs, but the judiciary would greet my departure with considerable relief. In order to postpone the evil hour as long as possible, I am in need of the life support of a reasonably competent quack. Mind you, I do a great deal for my own health by what is known in the Sunday papers as, quote, sensible lifestyle, unquote. I'm careful to take, however rough and painful the experience may be, a considerable quantity of Pomeroy's Very Ordinary, which I've always found keeps me astonishingly regular. I force myself to consume substantial luncheons of steak and kidney pud and mashed potatoes in the pub opposite the Old Bailey, and I do this in order to ward off infection and prevent weakness during the afternoon. My customary exercise consists of a short stroll from the Temple Tube station to Equity Court and rising to object to impertinent questions put by prosecuting counsel. I avoid all such indulgences as jogging or squash, activities which I have known to put an early end to many a promising career at the bar. The quack, by appointment to the House of Rumpole, used to be a certain Dr. McClintock, a Scot of the most puritanical variety, who put me on the scales and sentenced me to a spell on nothing more sustaining than a kind of chemical gruel called thinovite. He did this with the avowed intent of causing a certain quantity of Rumpole to vanish into thin air and leave not a rack behind. I've never felt that this was a scheme likely to contribute to anyone's good health, and readers of these chronicles will recall that McClintock kicked the bucket not long after prescribing it. The poor old darling was your pessimistic brand of quack who foresees death following hard upon your next slap-up tea of crumpets and Dundee cake. So, you don't want a quack who is too gloomy and turns your mind to being carried downstairs in your box by sweating undertaker's men complaining of the weight. On the other hand, the quack who tells you there's absolutely nothing wrong with you and you've got the liver of a 5-year-old and you'll probably go on forever, that is also disconcerting. Does he protest too much? Is he just trying to keep up your spirits? And has he secretly informed ye who must be obeyed that you have at the best 2 more weeks to live? On the whole, and to sum up, all you can say is that a man's relationship with his quack is a matter of mutual confidence and judicious balance. When Dr. McClintock was translated to the great geriatric ward in the skies, the responsibility for the health and well-being of the Rumpels eventually passed to Dr. Ghulam Ramat. Dr. Ramat had been highly spoken of by McClintock, who had made him a partner in that small quackery which served the area around Froxbury Mansions. He was a short, thick-set man, perhaps in his late 40s, with greying hair and large, melting brown eyes behind heavy spectacles. He was the most optimistic, indeed encouraging, quack I have ever known. "How are you, Rumpole?" Hilda approached at the nuptial couch. "I am dying, Egypt, dying." She who must be obeyed, whose title, as you will know, originally derives from the legendary and all-powerful Queen Cleopatra, answered me with a brisk, "Then we'd better call the doctor." "Call nobody," I warned her, wincing at the deafening sound of my own voice in competition with the vacuum cleaner. "I am remaining in bed. There is nothing on today except a chambers meeting to consider the case of a Mrs. Whittaker who wants to come in as a pupil to Erskine Brown. That is something worth missing. If Henry telephones, tell him that Rumpole's life is ebbing quietly away." "Oh, stuff and nonsense, Rumpole. You drank too much, that's all." Was that all? My head felt as though I had just received a short back and sides from the mad axeman of Luton, and a number of small black fish seemed to be swimming before my eyes. No doubt it was all because the Lord Chancellor, in a moment of absent-mindedness, had decided to make Hoskins a circuit judge. Hoskins, the colourless and undistinguished member of our chambers, mainly concerned with the heavy cost of educating his four daughters, had never found it easy to come by or do his briefs. Now, presumably on the basis that if you can't argue cases, you'd be better off deciding them, Hoskins had been elevated to the circus bench. The net result was a party in chambers at which the large and hungry-looking daughters Hoskins appeared and giggled over their sherry. This soiree was followed by a longer and more serious session in Pomeroy's, which had ended once again, I regret to say, with Henry and me recalling the great hits of Dame Vera Lynn. So now I turned my face to the wall, closed my eyes, and knew what it was like to stand loitering on the edge of eternity. And how is the great barrister at law feeling now? I was awoken from a troubled doze by a voice which sounded like that of an actor playing the part of an Indian doctor. His dialogue also had the sound of words invented to create a character. This was my first meeting with him, but in all our subsequent encounters, I felt that there was something unreal, almost theatrical, about Ghulam Rahmat and the way he pronounced the absurd title he always insisted on giving me, Barrister at Law. I am, I confess, to the smiling character at my bedside, feeling like death. Temporary, sir, a purely temporary indisposition. No need to fly the flag over the Old Bailey at half-mast yet a while. Tomorrow they will be rejoicing there. The crowds in the street will be cheering. Words will go round. The great barrister at law is returned to us stronger than ever. I have told your good lady while you were sleeping, sir. From the look of him, your husband strikes me as strong as a horse. Now, I had a lifetime's experience of the evil after-effects of overindulgence in Pomeroy's plonk, but they had up till now not included the presence of an Asian quack doing Peter Sellers' impressions at the Rumpo bedside. I appealed to Hilda, who had joined the party. Did you tell Dr. Ramata Ghulam, a medical doctor, Bachelor of Arts at the University of Bombay? A professional like you, sir, but not with a title so imposing and universally feared as barrister at law. Did you tell Dr. Rahmat that I was feeling near to death? I asked Hilda. We are all near to death. The thought seemed to cause the doctor a good deal of amusement. He began to laugh, but suppressed the sound as though it were somehow impolite, like a belch. But no doubt Mr. Rumpole will survive us all. Sit up, please. Will you do me the honour to let me listen to your chest? Oh, what a lung you have there, sir. It is a pleasure to listen to your hearty breathing. No doubt about it, you will go on forever. Oh, really? I must say the man had cheered me up considerably. So there's nothing seriously wrong? Nothing at all. I diagnose a severe attack of the collywobbles, brought on by food poisoning, perhaps. Food poisoning? She who must repeated unbelievably. For which I prescribe 2 Alka-Seltzers in a glass of water, strong black coffee, a quiet day in bed, and even more than the usual kindness and consideration from your lady wife. And tomorrow we shall say the barrister at law is himself again. When she had seen the medical man off the premises and returned to the sick room, I restrained myself from telling Hilda that for her to treat me with more than her usual kindness and consideration wouldn't greatly tax her ingenuity. Instead, I gave her a weak smile and quaffed the Alka-Seltzer. What a very charming and sensible quack, I said, as I effervesced quietly. But events were soon to occur which placed considerable doubt on the charm and good sense of Dr. Ghulam Rahmat. The following facts emerged during the subsequent proceedings. At 10:30 a.m. on the day in question, the waiting room in the local surgery was full of assorted bronchioles, flus, eczemas, rheumatics, carbuncles, and suspected and feared antisocial diseases. The receptionist, a Miss Dankwartz, was seated behind her desk in charge of the proceedings. The names of the doctors were written upon an electric device on the wall behind her, and beside each name a red light flashed if they were engaged, or a green if they were available. At the moment with which we are concerned, Dr. Ramat's light was red, as he was seeing a Miss Marietta Liptrot, who had been waiting to be treated for a sore throat. She had previously been a patient of Dr. Cogger, but as he was busy, she had asked specifically for the Indian doctor. Miss Liptrot had been closeted with her chosen quack for about 10 minutes, when a scream was heard from behind Dr. Ramat's door. With her clothes somewhat disarrayed, she flew past the assorted complaints and the startled receptionist, and crying, "The beast! The beast!" rushed out of the building and into the wastelands around the Gloucester Road. The doctors were accustomed to press their buttons as soon as a patient left, but Dr. Ramat's light remained red for some time after Miss Liptrot ran out. When it changed to green and his next patient, a Mrs. Rodway, was admitted, she found the doctor nervous, apparently unable to concentrate on her urticaria, and looking, so the witness was to testify, as though he'd had the fright of his life. Toward the end of the afternoon surgery on that day, that is to say, shortly after 6 o'clock, I happened to call in to get a prescription for She Who Must Be Obeyed, whose blood pressure is inclined to rise, especially if I've overstayed my allotted time in Pomeroy's. The surgery was almost empty, but a youngish man in a blue suit was opening his briefcase on the receptionist's desk, and I saw it contained a number of printed folders, pill bottles, and a portable telephone. I took him to be the rep for a firm of manufacturing chemists, and he was rattling on about the wonders of a miracle cure for something or other, when Dr. Cogger's light went green, and he shot out of his door and recognized me. "Hello there, Mr. Rumpel." Now, Tim Cogger had treated me on a number of occasions for temporary voice loss, the occupational hazard of Old Bailey hacks and opera singers. He was considerably younger than old McClintock, but he seemed to have inherited the leadership of the practice. Cogger was the hearty type of quack who once played rugby football for Barts and seemed to believe in the short, sharp shock treatment for most illnesses. He was continually complaining that his patients were typical national health pill scroungers, and on my rare visits to him, he seemed to regard a head cold as the mark of a wimp. "You're looking perfectly well," he told me, as though daring me to complain of anything. "I was looking for Dr. Ramat," I said. "He promised my wife a prescription." "Ah, I'm afraid Ramat's gone home. He may not be back at work for a day or two. If it's for Mrs. Rumpel, perhaps I could help." Dr. Cogger then got the receptionist to look up Hilda's records and scribbled a new prescription in the most obliging manner. I then knew nothing of the dramatic events of the morning, but that evening it was certainly service with a smile down at the local quackery. In due course, Miss Marietta Liptrot sent in a complaint to the General Medical Council, alleging approaches made to her by Dr. Ramat far beyond the call of medical duty. With the ponderous tread which characterizes all judicial proceedings, that august body began to move towards the trial of my encouraging quack for serious professional misconduct. Meanwhile, life in Equity Court continued as usual without any earth-shaking changes. Uncle Tom perfected his putts in the clerk's room, where Henry and Diane did their best to control their emotions and only allowed themselves a few covert glances of mutual adoration as they unwrapped their sandwiches at lunchtime. Ms. Liz Probert tried to start a movement to turn Chambers into a cooperative dedicated to the entirely fallacious principle that all barristers are created equal. But whenever she brought up the subject, Claude Erskine Brown stuffed bits of his Walkman into his ears, and she was left listening to the distant twittering of Di Valcure. Phyllida Erskine Brown, our Portia, continued to star in a number of corps célèbres, and enjoyed a success which Claude took with manful resignation. Sam Ballard made out a list of do's and don'ts for members of chambers, which he pinned up on the notice board in the clerk's room. This included such precepts as, "Do not allow such articles as solicitors' letters or witness statements to be dropped into the upstairs lavatory." Well, sometimes there seemed to be no other place for them. "Do not be seen drinking with a lay client in a Fleet Street wine bar. This sort of thing brings chambers into disrepute." Well, it had been the 40th anniversary of Fred Timpson's first court appearance under my auspices. Finally, to show that Ballard was deeply concerned about the environment, "Do remember the forests. Save paper." To which I had added, on my return from Pomeroy's after the glass or two with Fred, "And don't waste it on bloody silly notices in the clerk's room." After which the list vanished mysteriously, no doubt to be recycled and re-emerge as a Green Party newsletter. "Ah, Rumpel, a word with you," Sam Ballard accosted me one morning. "I wanted to let you know Heather Whittaker has joined us as Erskine Brown's pupil." He uttered this news with a good deal of awe and wonder, as though announcing that the Queen Mother had agreed to drop in afternoons to answer the telephone.
"I just wanted to explain this to you. She is not young. She is taking up the bar in middle life, and she is a thoroughly nice type of person."
"Oh, good," I told him. "We could do with a few of those around here."
"I think you were away when we had the chambers meeting and agreed to take her."
"Yes," I remembered. "I was dying."
"Oh, really?"
I was afraid I detected in Soapy Sam's eye a glimmer of hope. "Yes, but I changed my mind. I'm not dying anymore. Sorry to disappoint you."
Well, I want to make this quite clear to you. Mrs. Whittaker is, well, not the sort of person who would enjoy rough behaviour in chambers. Members coming in, perhaps from some wine bar, singing, and so on."
"You mean she doesn't like Dame Vera Lynn?"
"And I don't suppose she would relish a working environment where people scribble obscenities on notices pinned up in the clerk's room."
"Does it occur to you, Ballard," I said, "that the Whittaker woman may have joined the wrong profession?"
"She was at Girton."
This news seemed to me quite irrelevant.
"With my cousin, Joyce."
"Oh, well, this isn't Girton. She'll be in daily contact with murder, grievous bodily harm, and indecent exposure. She'll have to take in incest, adultery, and dubious magazines with her tea and buns. You're not seriously suggesting she's going to scream with horror at a piece of graffiti on the notice board, are you? Anyway, it wasn't obscene."
"Ah, there! There! I'm glad you admit you wrote it!"
Ballard looked triumphant. "I admit nothing," I said. "So what's this new pupil going to specialise in? The theft of knitting patterns?" "Oh, excuse me, Ballard. I'm off to confer about a bit of gross indecency on the National Health. Don't tell La Whittaker. She might have a fit of the vapours." In fact, I had a conference in a type of litigation new to me. During a life spent earning my crusts before some pretty unlikely tribunals, I had never yet appeared before the General Medical Council. But Dr. Ramat had telephoned me and told me he was in trouble. I had fixed him up with the dependable Bernard as an instructing solicitor, and he was even then waiting for me in my consulting room, an ailing medic who hoped that Rumpole would work the miracle cure. In all my troubles and tribulations, I had one thought to comfort me. I know an absolutely wizard barrister at law. Dr. Ramat was no longer smiling. He sat in my client's armchair looking somewhat thinner and older than when he had stood at my bedside. But he was still playing the Indian doctor in a way which he seemed to hope I would find entertaining. "How could I be accused of such a dreadful thing? Me, Ghulam Ramat. All my life I have been a peaceful fellow. I have been anxious to please and to make trouble for no one." "Perhaps you were too anxious to do what you thought would please Miss Liptrot," I felt like saying. Instead, I asked him to tell me about himself. He told me about his training in Bombay, his coming to England, and discovering there was a vacancy in old McClintock's practice. Dr. McClintock was a man who showed no prejudices at all. I said, "Do you mind taking on an Indian doctor in your very British practice?" "Certainly not," he told me. "You can be as Indian as you damn well please." I looked at the smiling client and had the strange idea that the exaggerated accent and vocabulary had been put on to oblige Dr. McClintock, who wanted to demonstrate his open-mindedness. "And how are things," I asked, "since Dr. Cogger's taken over?" "Oh, just the same," the smile continued. "Dr. Tim Cogger is a thoroughly good man, a chap with a fine sense of humor. You know what they say of him at Bart's? He was a great practical joker. Perhaps not a brilliant doctor, but are you?" "A what?" "A brilliant doctor." "Oh, most of us are not. Most of us are at a loss, more than we like to admit. But we try to be kind and cheerful and wait for the disease to go away. To be perfectly frank, that is how I treated the great barrister at law. I'm afraid," I had to break the news to him, "Miss Marietta Liptrot doesn't seem likely to go away." "No, dash it all." His cheerfulness, which had come back as he described his professional life so candidly, had drained away like bathwater, leaving him disconsolate again. "Oh, what a pain in the neck. If I can be so jolly rude about the young lady. Had you seen her before?" "No. And if I have to be honest with you, I hope and pray I never see her again." "What did she look like?" For an answer, he took out his wallet and handed me a cutting from the Daily Beacon. "First time," he said ruefully, "that I ever got my name in the paper. Indian doctor tried to strip and make love to me. Nanny tells of surgery antics," blared the headline. The story went on. "Children's nurse, Marietta Liptrot, 27, who works for a wealthy Kensington family, only had a sore throat. But Dr. Ramat had his own ideas about treatment. He made her lie down on a couch," she said in her complaint to the General Medical Council, "and wanted her to pull down her knickers. Dr. Ghulam Ramat, 50, who only came to England 12 years ago, said, 'I have the best barrister in the country, and I shall fight this every inch of the way.' I was looking at Miss Liptrot's photograph. A pale face with large, trusting eyes, and an upper lip drawn over slightly protruding teeth. This gave her a breathless and eager look. 'I never took a shine to her, Mr. Rumpel, to be perfectly frank with you.' 'What's your situation, Doctor? Have you a wife?' 'Had, Mr. Rumpel. There is poor hygiene in some of our hospitals, and I lost her. My son is in Bombay, studying. He hopes in his humble way to be a barrister at law, third class, merely. Not in your league, I may say.' To my embarrassment, I saw tears in the eyes behind his heavy spectacles. We hacks see clients at their most emotional moments, but remain oddly embarrassed when they start weeping. So, what's our defense?" I was anxious to get back to business. "The same," he announced with great satisfaction, "as in E.M. Forster's fine work, A Passage to India." When I was up at Oxford studying night and day for my record-breaking fourth in law, I remembered a chap called Perkins who greatly admired this Forster. He told me that personal relationships were all important, and if he had to choose between betraying his country or Rumpel, he hoped he'd choose his country. Happily, Perkins became a clergyman in Wales and didn't have to make this agonizing decision, but he did get me to read A Passage to India, the gist of which had, I was ashamed to say, now slipped my mind. "Oh, of course," I said, yes, just remind me of the plot." "Well, this English lady accuses an Indian doctor of raping her in the Malabar Caves," the doctor reminded me. "Ah, yes, of course. Yes, it all comes back to me. And what was his defense, exactly?" that it all went on in her fevered imagination.
Yes, I see. I was a little doubtful. And how did it work out?
Oh, he was acquitted. You will enjoy a similar triumph, great barrister at law.
Yes, well, let's hope so. I was by no means convinced. We've got to remember that this was a work of fiction. I then brought the doctor down to earth by trying to get his exact clinical reasons for asking a patient who had come in to complain of a sore throat to remove her knickers. When Dr. Ramat left me, he was in a mood of unbridled optimism. I wandered out into the passage with my mind set on a little refreshment at Pomeroy's. The door of Erskine Brown's room opened, and out stepped a well-groomed, neatly dressed grey-haired lady who greeted me with a friendly smile and carefully controlled cry of, Mr. Rumpole, isn't it?
A piece of him, I told her.
Oh, I've been so longing to meet you. I'm Heather Whittaker, Erskine Brown's pupil. I've taken to the bar rather late in life, I'm afraid.
Yes, it's probably a profession for the aged, I consoled her. The young can't stand the pace.
You're a legend, Mr. Rumpole. Of course you know that. I'm absolutely dying to hear you on your feet.
Well, I said hospitably, why not pop along to the General Medical Council? I've got a doctor in trouble.
Oh, I'd love that. She seemed genuinely enthusiastic. Of course, I've heard Erskine Brown on his feet.
Oh, really? I said. Did you manage to keep awake?
Just about. She allowed herself a small but charming giggle. With you, I'm sure I should be on the edge of my seat. What's your doctor been up to?
Oh, I'd better not tell you. Our head of chambers says you shock easily.
What nonsense! Her smile widened. I want to know all the gory details.
I must say that Ballard was right about one thing. Our new pupil, Mrs. Heather Whittaker, seemed a nice type of person. My life at that time was bedeviled by women. Not only had a person of that persuasion got my unfortunate doctor in trouble, but a client of mine, similarly constituted, was becoming a pain in my neck.
So, she's been ringing up again,
said she who must be obeyed in threatening tones as I got home that evening.
She? I asked with carefully simulated innocence. Who on earth's she?
Of course, I knew perfectly well.
She was the worst driver who ever skidded her gleaming white Volkswagen off the Uxbridge Road, mounted the pavement, terrorized the passers-by, hit a municipal waste disposal bin and someone's mobile shopping basket, and finally crashed into a lamppost. The driver's name was Mrs. Bambi Etheridge. Only Rumpole's skill and the fact that the chief prosecution witness lectured the lady chairman of the bench on the hopeless incompetence of women drivers led to her triumphant acquittal on the grounds of poor road surface and fast oncoming traffic. Whatever might be said of her as a driver, Mrs. Etheridge was a social menace. She was a generously built lady who, as she moved, clattered with what I believe is known as costume jewellery and gave off a deafening smell of what she was at pains to tell me was deadly sins by Saint-Just. Her hair was unconvincingly blonde, and her makeup strove to represent the effect of too much sunbathing in Florida. She spoke as though she were trying to attract the attention of a deaf and uncooperative waiter on the far side of a noisy dining room. Mr. Rumpole, she bellowed as we came out of court, you are an absolute sweetie. How can I reward you, Mr. Rumpole, darling?
I told her it was normal to do it with a check sent through her solicitors.
Oh, no, I mean something more personal. What about a naughty lunch? Just the two of us? Could you get a long afternoon off? And do you enjoy scrumptious desserts as much as I do? Oh, good. All men enjoy scrumptious desserts, don't they? That's settled, then. I'll give you a tinkle. Are you in the book? I'm sure you are.
Lunch, I said regretfully, for I'm particularly fond of lunch. No, I'm afraid that's impossible. The pressure of work, you see. Oh, come on, Mr. Rumpel. Give yourself a bit of fun, why don't you? Has anyone ever told you you're a very cuddly sort of barrister? My blood ran cold. I saw Mr. Bernard, our admirable instructing solicitor, avert his eyes in shame. And this woman was going in search of my telephone number. I fervently wished I had lost her case, and she was even now being led off to the dungeons. Mrs. Etheridge, please don't trouble yourself to telephone. I'm afraid I rarely lunch out nowadays. In fact, I do nothing except work. All work and no play makes Mr. Rumpel a dull boy. She slapped my wrist lightly. And I'm sure you're not that, are you? Oh, be seeing you. And with that she was gone, with a whiff of deadly sins, a carillion of costume jewellery, and the relentless beat of her high heels on the entrance hall of the Uxbridge Magistrates' Court. 3 evenings later, the telephone rang in Froxbury Mansions. Hilda answered it, frowned with extreme displeasure, and handed me the instrument with a grim, "There's a woman asking for you who rejoices in the name of Bambi Etheridge." "Oh," I said weakly, "what does she want?" "God knows what she wants with you, Rumpel. You'd better ask her." "Yes?" I barked into the instrument in a way which I hoped would put an end once and for all to the hideous notion that I am in the least cuddly. "Rumpel speaking." "Oh, dear." The Etheridge menace appeared to coo down the line. "Is it a bad moment? Are you with your wife? Ought I to have pretended to be the waterboard or something?" "No," I said firmly, "I don't think you can." "Can what, Mr. Rumpel? What are you suggesting? I only rang to invite you to lunch."
"I don't think you can get costs against the police," I said. "Yes, yes, I know you won, but you did hit a lamppost. It was quite a reasonable prosecution to bring. I'm sorry, that's my final legal opinion."
"Oh, of course," Bambi purred understandingly. "You can't talk now, can you?" "I'll ring again."
"Don't do it," I said. "You'll be throwing good money after bad by appealing."
"What a thing to say. You're not bad money, are you, Mr. Rumpel? I'll ring again when you're not in the bosom of your family. Bye."
"Stupid woman," I said when I put the phone down. "She wants to appeal on costs."
"Oh, yes." Hilda looked at me with profound disbelief. "Is that why she called you my lovely husband?" "She didn't." "She did to me?" I said, "Hilda Rumpel speaking," and she said, "Oh, yes. And is your lovely husband about by any chance?"
"Oh, look, Hilda, I felt called upon to defend myself on a most serious charge of which I was undoubtedly innocent, having been put in the frame by the appalling Bambi. She is only a customer."
"Well, that poor girl was only a customer of Dr. Ramat's, wasn't she? And look what happened to her."
"And she who must be obeyed adjourned for supper, clearly having made up her mind without the need for further argument." I did get taken out for an expensive lunch not long after that fatal phone call, and I was invited by a lady whose brains and beauty far exceeded the modest attainments in either of those departments by Bambi Etheridge. Mrs. Phillida Erskine Brown, QC, our Porsche, knocked at my door in chambers late one morning and said, "Come on, you old devil, I'm taking you out to lunch." Expecting a couple of sandwiches at Pomeroy's, I was surprised when she said, "Savoy Grill suits you, would it?" "Oh, well, I admit it, if we're really roughing it. But what's come over you, Portia? Are they putting you on the High Court bench?" "They're not putting me anywhere," she said. "The question is, where am I putting myself? I'm just about fed up, Rumpel. I've had it up to here. So we're going out to spend what's left of Claude's money, and I hope he finds that boring." With which enigmatic statement, she set off along the Strand at a pace so brisk that I had to break into a trot to keep up with her. It was not until we were seated on the plush and had our hands round a couple of cocktails that Phyllida started to unburden herself. "Rumpole," she said, "tell me honestly, am I boring?" "Ah, whatever gave you that idea?" "Am I a rut?" "Oh, scarcely." "Humdrum? Would you call me humdrum?" I looked at our Portia. Her hair was reddish, inclined to gold. Her face, that of one of the most intelligent pre-Raphaelite models, had grown, I thought, finer in the years since I had known her. The formal white blouse and dark suit, combined with the horn rims she used to read the menu, merely added to that charm which had in the past completely turned the heads of such connoisseurs of feminine beauty as the Hon. Mr. Justice Featherstone. As I looked at her, the only wonder was how, all those years ago, she had been put in the club and then married by a character as unexotic as my learned friend Claude Erskine Brown. Run of the mill. Am I run of the mill? You are certainly not, Portia. Apart from her beauty, Mrs. Erskine Brown had brains. Not for nothing had I named her Portia. When she spoke up for the defense, the general opinion in the jury box was that if a nice girl like that was on his side, the villain in the dock couldn't be nearly as black as he was painted. When prosecuting, she could pot the prisoner with all the aplomb of the avenging angel on a good day. "Men," she now said, "are all the same." "Oh, are we? I'm not sure I'm exactly like Claude." "Oh, perhaps not you, Rumpole. You're not really interested, are you?" "Not interested in what?" "In what everybody else who happens to be male seems to spend their time thinking about. Sex." "Oh, that," I said, and gave a small shudder of fear at the thought of returning home to be cooed at over the telephone by Bambi. "They're all the same. Take that wretched doctor of yours." "Oh, Dr. Ramat. A woman has only to wander into his surgery with a sore throat, and he's trying to get into her knickers, just like Claude." "Claude looks after people with sore throats?" I wasn't following her drift. "I'll get him, though. I'll cross-examine the life out of him. He'll be struck off for 10 years. "Claude? No, no, Dr. Ramat. Well, what's Dr. Ramat got to do with it?" "Well, I'm prosecuting him before the General Medical Council." "First rate." I tried to sound enthusiastic, but I saw the unhappy doctor's hopes fading rapidly. "I'll have a foeman worthy of my steel." "Oh, I'm sorry, foe person. You've got to be so careful when you talk to lady barristers nowadays." "I don't know how you could defend a person like that." "Portia, you know I have to defend a person like anyone. But you couldn't defend a real snake. Dr. Ramat, no!" And she added in such a tone that I came to the conclusion that hell hath absolutely no fury like a scorned Mrs. Phyllida Erskine Brown, QC. "Claude!" "Oh, all right," I said. "What's Claude done now?" As the waiter had set smoked salmon and Sancerre before us, it seemed a suitable moment to get on with putting the indictment. By way of answer, Mrs. Erskine Brown opened the slender black briefcase she had brought with her and produced a copy of a somewhat lurid magazine called Casanova. On the cover of this publication, a bikini-clad young woman disported herself with a medicine ball, both articles looking as though they had been inflated with a bicycle pump. "Let me read you this." Phyllida flicked through what were, no doubt, distressing pages of photographs, and came to rest among the advertisements, which, when I got a chance to examine them at my leisure, were mostly of the lonely hearts variety. "Barrister, good-looking and young at heart," Phyllida read in tones of such disgust that they almost put me off my lunch. "In a rut, bored with the humdrum of married life, seeks a new partner for the occasional fling. Country walks, opera going, 3-star restaurant treats, and all the other pleasures of life. Tall and slender preferred. Write with a photograph, if possible, too. And there's a box number. There you are. Read it for yourself, if you want to." She almost threw the exhibit at me, drained her wine glass at a gulp, and ordered us both a refill from the waiter. I glanced at it as I asked, "So, how do you connect this with Claude?" "Well, it's obvious, isn't it? He's a barrister and opera-going. Oh, Portia, there are about 4,000 barristers, and some of them must go to the opera. I don't think, Mrs. Erskine-Brown, that your evidence is absolutely conclusive. I found this in his room in Chambers, Rumpole, Phyllida said between gritted teeth. Now, what further proof do you want?
Oh, I see. This last piece of testimony did seem to have landed the unfortunate Claude in the manure. Well, I admitted, things are beginning to look rather black for the accused. As I said this, I was glancing further down the pages of Casanova and found boxes announcing the service of escorts and ladies equipped to give massage treatment in the hotel or home. These announcements were embellished with photographs, and one struck me as familiar. It was under the heading, Naughty Marietta Will Keep You Company at Dinners Out or Business Functions. There was a snap of this companionable girl. Her hair had been done over more elaborately than when she appeared in the Daily Beacon, but there was no mistaking the wide eyes and small even features and slightly protruding teeth of Miss Liptrot, the girl who was about to bring about the downfall of Dr. Rummett. During the beef and Beaujolais, our Portia rattled on about her husband's character defects and his pathetic failure even to be unfaithful without advertising for it in the public prints. Then, perhaps feeling that she had confided too much, she remembered a conference in Chambers, paid the bill, and left me. She went so hurriedly, in fact, that I found myself still in possession of the copy of Casanova, and I finished the Bruit, which would never have been seen dead in Pomeroy's, and again contemplated the features of the undoubted Miss Liptrot. Dr. Ramat's case seemed to follow me around that day, for glancing across the restaurant, I spotted the large, muscular, and jovial figure of Dr. Tim Cogger, lunching profusely with someone I recognized as the fellow with the briefcase who had apparently been trying to flog his pills and potions round the quackery. I raised what remained in my glass in salutations, but Dr. Ramat's senior partner, although he glanced in my direction, seemed to have noticed me not at all. When I got back to my room in Chambers, I popped Casanova up on my desk, got a line from Henry, and started to dial. I heard a ringing tone, and as I was saying, "Is that the Naughty Marietta escort service?" I was aware of the door opening, and our head of chambers sidled into the room and stood agape as I heard the whispered reply, "Yes, this is Marietta speaking." Marietta Liptrot, I presume? Who are you? Are you the newspapers?
No, I promise you, just someone in need of an escort. I heard from a friend of mine that you were a very companionable young lady.
Oh, well, yes, I suppose that's all right.
There was a pause, but no denial of the name.
When's the function?
Well, it's not for me, actually. I raised my voice slightly and turned to smile at the intruder. It's for a friend of mine. He wants to take you along to add a little colour to a ladies' night at the Lawyers as Christian Society. Call you back with the details. Nice to talk to you, Miss Liptrot. I put down the telephone.
Rumpole, is that your idea of a joke?
Well, you shouldn't have been standing there listening to a private conversation.
I couldn't help hearing that you were using Chambers' telephone facilities to call up an escort agency.
Of course you can help it. You could have beaten a hasty retreat.
Rumpole, you are a married man.
Oh, that has not escaped my attention.
I don't ask why you should feel the need to do that sort of thing.
Oh, good. Nice to chat to you, Bollard. Now, if you don't mind closing the door on your way out. He moved toward the exit and then paused.
Rumpole, he said solemnly, don't you think you ought to make a clean breast of it to Hilda?
A clean breast of what?
The fact that you're troubled by those sort of, needs.
Ballard, I looked at the man with pity. when you next feel the need to talk absolute balderdash, why don't you go and make a clean breast of it to matey? He went then, but he was back in a twinkling, his head round the door.
I forgot where I dropped in, he confessed.
On the chance of earwigging a salacious phone call, I suggested.
No, it wasn't that. Ah, now I remember. I've had a word with Mrs. Whittaker. It seems you asked her to take a note for you in the GMC case of yours. Are you sure it's not distasteful in any way?
I promise. She can resort to earplugs for the more sensational parts of the evidence. When I was finally relieved of Bollard's company, I continued a close study of infectious mononucleosis in the Principles and Practice of Medicine, which I had got out of the library. Then I called on Mrs. Erskine Brown to return the incriminating magazine she had left with me in the restaurant. There you are, I said, when I entered the comfortably appointed QC's room Phillida inhabited, apart from her husband. I dropped the distasteful magazine on her desk. You left the vital evidence in the restaurant. What are you going to do to the unfortunate Claude? Confront him with it? No good at all. She came to a quick legal decision. He'd only say it wasn't him, or something equally devious. No, I shall trap him with it. Leave him absolutely no way of escape. Traps were being set all around by Phillida. Not only for Claude, but for the unfortunate Dr. Ramat as well.